The Engineering Commons is a podcast dedicated to the challenges that engineers encounter, regardless of which industry or field they work in on a regular basis. These can be overarching topics that affect us over our entire careers, or stories of everyday frustrations and how to deal with them. This is the episode for October 3rd, 2013, in which we discuss nuclear energy. So, Adam, how do you get energy out to the job site when you're building a road?
Well, we're very advanced and high tech and use a lot of diesel fuel.
Right.
And then there's always the good old fashioned manual labor.
Right.
But we're really kind of out there on our own, running on fossil fuels and whatever we can put into our trucks.
Right. I see from time to time, you know, the road crews have the signs out there that are running off of solar, but a lot of times, at least maybe it's still the case, there used to be where you'd see the diesel generator sitting right next to the sign to keep it going.
I guess I haven't seen a lot of that. We hope that doesn't happen.
Okay. I'm thinking maybe a few years past, but I definitely did see a gas or diesel generator sitting there next to a big electronic sign to keep it lit up.
I can believe it would happen. We try whenever possible to run into the grid. It's just an efficient source of power. But we're pretty old school with most of our energy sources.
Now, from time to time, I see when they're building an intersection or something like that, they'll set up, it looks to me like it's a cement or concrete, like a little mini mixing plant there by the intersection. Do you know how they get power to that?
Usually they bring their own generators and pretty much have to be self-sustaining for most of our functions.
So fossil fuel again.
Yep.
Okay.
The biggest cost in road construction is energy, fuel.
Yeah. If I was trying to relay the most important lesson of engineering to others, I generally think in terms of energy conversion. You know, it's all... You convert stuff from kinetic energy to potential, or from potential energy to kinetic energy, or you move it from fuel to create electricity, or there's some sort of energy conversion going on. But I think that in all fields of engineering, energy is an important consideration to what you do.
Yeah, it's one of those fundamental laws of physics you can never really escape.
Right. Right. Well, tonight we're going to talk a little bit about energy, and in particular, a form of energy that most of us know about tangentially, but probably not a whole lot about, and that's nuclear energy. And our guest this evening is Akira Tokahiro, who was a former classmate of mine. We went to Purdue together, and he is now a professor of mechanical and nuclear engineering at the University of Idaho. So, Akira, welcome to the Engineering Commons.
Yes, thank you very much for having me on.
Well, glad that you could join us.
Yeah, thank you.
So, Akira, what got you interested in the field of engineering?
I guess you've seen that cartoon about the mother at the doctor's with the son. No, he's got the...
Oh, the
whatever.
Knack.
He's got the knack, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Dilbert.
Yeah. I think that's where I started. I mean, my mother told me that I took her sewing machine apart as soon as I learned how to use a screwdriver. When I was maybe two or three. So I pulled all the screws out. So
Sure that made her very happy.
Yeah. So that plus risk taking, I think that was evident very early. My mother told me another story that she took me to the department store and I pulled the fire alarm.
Just to see what would happen?
Yes. Yeah. So those two events are kind of, yeah, I think that pointed me to engineering very early.
In your schooling, at least at Purdue, we all went through freshman engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But what pushed you in the area of nuclear engineering?
Well, that was much later. I had shortly before I started at Purdue in 77, along about maybe 74, 75, I was started getting interested in Formula One. Race cars,
okay.
And I'm more on the engineering side, the technical developments and challenges. So, for many years, I chased. Actually, all the way through almost through the end of my PhD, I was writing letters to Formula One teams to try to get on to get an interview. And so, I think through that hobby and passion, I think I stumbled upon system engineering or system integration. And then I just happened to, through an internship or short, you know, research stay after at Argonne National Laboratory at, through where my father had been working, mm-hmm. I got introduced to nuclear engineering. So that's how I ended up actually through Argonne National Lab in Chicago going back to Purdue. And I thought, oh, the reactor is really like a Formula One car that you have to know a lot of different things and then integrate them. So that's how I got interested in the reactors. And yeah, it's still pretty fascinating.
So I remember sitting in some class towards junior or senior year, and we were sitting there talking about whether we'd ever go to grad school. And I remember we had there a list of various colleges, and we were talking about the advantages and disadvantages of going to these various universities to get our grad degree in engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But my recollection is that you, when you finished up your undergrad degree, it wasn't in a traditional engineering field. It was like engineering science or something.
Yeah. That was for me. I'm a dot connector. I mean, I realized, 40 years later that I'm essentially a dot connector. And I think that was also evident. And I wanted to, Purdue had that interdisciplinary engineering also was IDE was also all decided eventually.
Yes.
So I got to put together my own curriculum and then put it through a faculty committee. And that was wonderful. So I did essentially engineering physics. Or engineering science. And so I did mostly physics and math, but then I did a sampling of electrical engineering and mechanical engineering courses that I really, in topics that I was really interested in. So, yeah, that's how I ended up with the engineering physics degree. And then for my master's, I went traditional, straight mechanical engineering degree at the University of Rochester.
Okay.
In Rochester, New York. Yeah.
And then at some point you worked for, do I have this right? You worked for Argonne before coming back to Purdue for your PhD?
Yeah, I did a year, and I was always kind of a hands-on, so I did like to do experiments. So I had a chance through kind of a junior engineer position, a short-term junior engineer position I was at Argonne National Lab, really working on gas and liquid flows and designing and building experiments for mm-hmm. one of the senior staff members. So.
And so when you came back to Purdue to do your PhD in nuclear engineering,
mm-hmm.
and that's not a big department in most schools. I mean, nuclear engineering is much smaller than, say, mechanical engineering or electrical engineering in the number of students that were there.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's possibly the smallest. I think at the time when I went back there in 85, I think it was 11 faculty. And, school Purdue has they call them the schools, right? They're kind of departments, but they're called them schools. So
right.
It's still a school of nuclear engineering. And it's still small. I think it's now up to about 17 faculty in the school. But, yeah, it's always been small. And then, the graduate student, at least 50 graduate students. So, it's small, but, it's has actually a pretty rich history. And at Purdue, so it's and Purdue's known for reactor safety and thermal hydraulics, and they produce some good graduates.
For those of us that come from other schools and don't know much about nuclear engineering, can you give us a sense of what kind of the specialities are in there? I mean, if I'm in mechanical engineering, I may specialize in controls
right.
or thermodynamics or fluid flow. What are the specialties in nuclear engineering?
Okay. Nuclear engineering is really everything that's can be everything that's about nuclear energy or nuclear power plants. So there is nuclear reactor engineering, and there's also reactor there's reactor design and engineering. There's the kind of a subdiscipline to focus on what's called thermal hydraulics. It's really designing the cooling system
right.
for the nuclear power plant. There's also an area called fuel design or fuel reactor core design, which mm-hmm. is really about the fuel and,
okay.
and how you load and unload and how you arrange the fuel in the core. not going to have an impact on the performance. So there's reactor physics, reactor nuclear reactor theory, and so forth. So that's another discipline. There's also fuel cycle analysis, which is really a supply chain analysis based on the fuel supply.
Mm-hmm.
There's also radiation health and safety, right? So because of the radioactivity, inherent radioactivity. Gosh, what else is there? There's, of course, there's material research. So there's fuel material research, and there's also non-fuel, mostly meaning structural materials like stainless steels and really materials that can go in the nuclear reactor, you know, grades of stainless steel, carbon steel, also some oxides and ceramics. So there's also that area, material science, nuclear materials is also a research area. So other than that, because of the often unfortunate connection to weapons, there's a kind of a more of a policy on aspect, non-proliferation, security and safeguards, and then you know, there's weapons grade materials. That's another area, and then as with many engineers, there's a large computational modeling and simulations, computational engineering area, and I guess the last thing is. I mean, there's fission reaction and the fusion reaction, so there's fusion engineering as well as part of nuclear engineering. So there's plasma physics and then fusion reactor design and experiments, and mostly so far, experimental facilities.
Right. So it sounds like even though it's a small school in number of faculty and students, there's no shortage of specialties in the field.
Yeah, and I didn't really mention there's a kind of a link between physics, applied physics, and nuclear engineering in terms of accelerator technology.
Okay.
Yeah, particle accelerator. So that's also requires physics knowledge and nuclear engineering knowledge.
And so what area did you concentrate in when you were getting your PhD?
Well, I've always been interested in fluid mechanics and heat transfer. So, you know, for me, the natural was nuclear reactor thermal hydraulics, and then reactor safety and severe accident. Now, what's called severe accident analysis. So,
okay,
yeah. So, I've always specialized in that, but I've dabbled in many of the areas. So, yeah, and that's me. I like I said, I like to connect dots. So, doing different things. The fact that the nuclear energy discipline has many different aspects is attractive to me. So. Yeah, so for the young folks, I guess if you're listening, then if you like to do a lot of different things, you know, if you don't like to be constrained, you like to do the physics, you can do the chemistry, you can do the math, you like the materials, you like to do experiments, you like to do computers, then nuclear energy, you might concern nuclear energy or nuclear engineering.
Now, you were saying that the department is, by Purdue standards, probably a little bit sparse. But it's a big field. So oftentimes in industry, are a lot of those fields backfilled by, say, people with pure electrical engineering, pure mechanical,
right.
Or
yeah,
pure
yeah.
chemical?
Yeah, and that's right. So many of the, you know, we have 105 or so nuclear power plants in the United States. We have, you know, quite a few utilities, you know, two large ones, Exelon and then Entergy. I think Exelon has some, you know, 20-some plants, and Entergy has 14 or 15 plants. And so and roughly speaking, we have about 1,000 majors at various, in about 20, 23, up to about 25 programs and departments across the United States, producing about 1,000 graduates a year. So, yeah, that's certainly insufficient compared to mechanical engineers, electrical engineers, so, or even civil engineers. So they get converted into partially converted into becoming nuclear engineers. That's kind of the in-house training that's done by the utilities.
Mm-hmm. Are all of your plasma physics buddies in France right now? Working on the ITER project?
Yeah, that comes and goes, and the U.S. participation in the ITER, in the international tokamak projects, you know, kind of off and on, so... That's even a smaller community. You know, the interest in plasma physics and fusion reactor has kind of a natural decline. So there are students who are still interested in that, but They would have to find each other on Facebook. So, yeah, many of the opportunities and the outlets that where you can pursue your plasma physics or fusion reactor interests, yeah, very limited in the world. So, yeah, I guess that's a test of how much you love it.
If there are lots of MEs, EEs, civils filling in to these nuclear engineering roles, do you see any big differences between nuclear engineering and other engineering fields?
Yeah. Typically, nuclear engineers can do all those subjects that I mentioned pretty well. So they can do the math, they don't shy away from chemistry. They can do the chemistry, they can do the physics, they can do the mathematics, they can do the computing. So they're kind of jack of all trades. But they actually, I guess their deep conviction is that they really love and believe in nuclear energy. So that's I think that's the kicker in terms of why students go into nuclear engineering.
You don't find students who, I guess it makes sense, but I'm trying to process this. So you don't find students in nuclear engineering who think nuclear power is a bad idea.
Usually not. They're, I think that's actually common to many engineers, or mechanical engineers. There's a passion for that major, because that degree gets them to work at as an automotive engineer, for example.
Right.
Yeah. So, I'm not sure that, you find many college freshmen, telling each other, I want to be a manufacturing engineer, but they certainly can tell you that I want to be a mechanical engineer.
Right.
And then in addition to that, they love automobiles, for example. So that mechanical engineering is a very diverse degree also. And that degree gets you on the road to becoming an automotive engineer.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I guess I didn't know if maybe somebody wanted to do, say, nuclear medicine. And so they went into nuclear engineering, even though they didn't want to have anything to do with a nuclear power plant.
Oh, yeah, that happens. I mean, you have people that, not many, but I think, in nuclear engineering, I always say there are about 6 or 7 different types of students. So one of them is that getting the nuclear engineering undergraduate degree. And, I know one graduate getting the undergraduate and the master's degree in nuclear engineering, but then had eyes on going to law school and doing nuclear energy law, something very specific. So, and there is a firm in Washington, D.C. that has something like, 60% of all the nuclear energy law business in the country.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are outlets for for very specific, subdisciplines. So,
right.
And you can go to med school. I mean, people who do nuclear engineering can go to med school, or even business school. And, get an MBA and then go into, nuclear installation management, or DOE,
okay.
Department of Energy. So,
right.
That's often done. I think, one out of six, nuclear engineering, majors, typically go to utilities, nuclear utilities.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say one out of six go to, get master's degree and then eventually end up in national labs.
Right.
Yeah. So, and then another one out of six go to Westinghouse or General Electric and this can become part of the manufacturer. So there are different outlets and then there's always been a shortage. So the job market is always been pretty good.
So there's not a whole lot of, there's not many nuclear power plants being built in the U.S. these days.
No.
So what's the activity worldwide and what are the companies like Westinghouse doing? Are they just improving their plans in case they get to build one, or are they actively building stuff around the world?
Well, there's,
and aren't there one or two under construction?
Yeah, we have, two or three under construction in Georgia and, the Southeast states, South Carolina, North Carolina, Georgia. So there are jobs there. And worldwide, they're building like gangbusters in China. and they plan to keep building, you know, a tremendous number of reactors in China over the next 30 years or so. So Westinghouse is there, General Electric is there, the French manufacturer Areva is there, you know, the Russian Rosatom is there, you know, everybody is there's almost there are infinite number of jobs, because China is really trying to establish the nuclear, not only the nuclear reactor supply chain, but also the workforce.
Right.
So yeah, that's where the growth is. And, you know, we have a few other, you know, Korea is still building, Europeans are still building, replacing old units by building, newer ones. And so, you know, it's hobbling along. Except in China, it's a tremendous growth there.
What do you think the future looks like in the States?
I think it looks reasonably good. We have a lot of aging plants, and the U.S. will have to make a choice at some time to replace those plants.
How long can you get end-of-life extensions out of plants that were built in the 60s and 70s?
The current is about, you know, 40 years or 50 years. There's research going on that's to extend that the service life to about 60 years, and then beyond that. So there's actually kind of a funny name called Life After 60, or so for plants, you know. So yeah, there is activity on how do you characterize the kind of the health and well-being of the materials beyond 60 years after they've been bombarded for 60 years with neutrons, for example. So
is the concern there metal embrittlement?
Yeah, it's embrittlement. It's irradiation induced, or neutrons are, it's like peening, right? So constantly, or sandblasting, you're constantly bombarding the material with neutrons, and there's an embrittlement process, yes. So, when things get brittle, and, it's possible that they can have a, you know, catastrophic fracture. So that's the concern, and that's very difficult to predict. Right. So, yeah, so far so good. I mean, plants are 25 to 35 years old and going to 40 and probably okay into 50, but beyond that, But it's like, just like human health, right?
Yeah.
So health and well-being, you know, when you're 40, when you're 50, when you're 60. So, there's a little bit of embrittlement there as well, right? So.
I was going to say, this sounds a lot like our approach to bridges in the U.S. Oh, we can get another 10 years. We can get another 10 years.
Right. And that's actually, that's an engineer speaking. For the love of a bridge or a 1970 Volkswagen Beetle or a nuclear reactor, you know, when do you replace a reactor that you love that was designed in the 60s and built in the 70s? You know, when do you replace that is the question. Part of it, a large part of it is money. But how do you characterize the state, the health and well-being of the bridge as a structure or as a material? So.
But I would also imagine, though, that the newer reactors, I mean, given that safety is such a strong consideration, that the newer reactors would be significantly safer given that, you know, we've had 20 years to kind of digest.
Yes.
The various nuclear accidents we've had.
Yeah. No, that's definitely true. I mean, that's, I tell my students, many of the reactors, let's talk about the Fukushima accident a second. You know, those are General Electric reactors that were designed in the 60s and built in the 70s, and we have about 22 or 23 units exactly the same as the ones in Fukushima. So I tell the students, you know, that's a 1970 Mustang. And, you know that a 2013 Mustang has more safety systems. So if you own a 1970 Mustang, you love that Mustang. So, sometimes it's hard to part with that and go for a 2013 Mustang. I personally would tell you the 2013 Mustang is not as good as the 1970 Mustang. So, but that's the love of an engineer with what they grow up with, right? So, in a way.
Is there a part of the, nuclear engineering community that really loves these reactors? You know, wants them to keep going, or would prefer to replace them with newer reactors.
Yeah, because nuclear engineers will typically tell you this: we designed this so that it lasts 60 years. Mm-hmm. At least 60 years, right? They might say at least 60 years. Not 60 years, but at least 60 years.
So they're disappointed if you don't make it the full length.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we have not reached that. We don't really have a reactor that's reached this full 60 years service life in the United States. So.
Are there any of the first generation left online?
No, we don't. We don't have really any that are any first generation reactors that came, that were really designed in the 50s, mid 50s, and then built in the early 60s. So we don't have any of those. Most of the fleet of 100 plants we have in the United States were Generation 2 reactors designed in the 60s, built in the 70s.
It's amazing what you can design with a slide rule.
Oh, yeah, slide rules and blueprints. So, the childhood story? Is it Rumpelstiltskin or you fall asleep for 30 years and you wake up? Or no, Rip Van Winkle.
Rip Van Winkle, yeah.
Yeah, Rip Van Winkle, as you fall asleep, that's nuclear energy. You fall asleep for 30 years, you wake up, and we're still using the same textbooks as 30 years ago. The only thing that's changed is that we're going to actually build a reactor with CAD. Nuclear energy has developed slowly, right? So there's definitely a Back to the Future theme to it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
Because we're building for the first time, I think the plants that are being built in Georgia and South Carolina, and so for the first time, with blueprints. I mean, not blueprints, CAD imaging.
I don't know how hard and fast the rules are for reactor generations. These are quote unquote third generation reactors, correct?
Third generation, yes. And we're doing the research for the fourth generation.
Now, are the third generation reactors that are being built in the U.S. the first third generations in the world, or
no? There are others that have already been built in Japan and Taiwan and Korea, and a few in Europe.
And is the major advantage? Greater energy density, greater safety.
Mostly greater safety in terms of not having to have. Human intervention in it's kind of a passive or automatic safety systems. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
I want to say the designs I saw had like water tanks that would do evaporative cooling for like 3 or 4 days.
Right. Yeah. The criteria is that you can walk away. You have enough safety systems so that it's self-regulating for at least 72 hours. On its own passively, it can maintain the condition or improve the cool down condition over the first 72 hours, because human beings tend to disagree. So, nothing for the first 72 hours, right? You can't get a group of engineers together and then have them decide anything in 24 hours. So,
I thought there was a textbook answer for everything.
So. That's the goal is 72 hours of no intervention so that you don't have to concern yourself with human factors and human performance.
What are the design concerns with the fourth generation?
Well,
and what's being imagined?
Passive safety or more automatic safety systems, kind of economic competitiveness in terms of design compared to other fuel energy sources, non-proliferation and security. Thermal efficiency, in terms of the engineered system. And I guess more and more reliability. I think we're kind of there with even Generation 2 systems in terms of reliability. But yeah, you have to realize that these are, this is an invention from the 50s, and and we're talking only about generation 4 or version 4. So, is there room for more improvement? I think there is, in terms of design and engineering.
You mentioned the Fukushima plant a little earlier. And I note that you were on the committee from the American Nuclear Society that reviewed that event. Can you give us just kind of a thumbnail sketch of what happened there, what went wrong, and what the next generation systems might do to prevent that?
Yeah. So that accident was in March, on March 11th, and then the American Nuclear Society president formed the committee mid-June or so. Mm-hmm. And then we wanted to issue a technical report. We mainly were had the mandate to look at the what technical issues there were, problems there were, and then to produce that report by the first anniversary. So a lot of work in the fall of 2011, and we looked mainly at the technical issues, and these were mostly General Electric reactors with different what's called a Mark 1 containment, Mark 2, and Mark 3 containments.
Mm-hmm.
What went wrong? I guess, like with many engineered systems, when you have something go wrong, I think the some of the safety systems did work. So they're earthquake-proof, the reactors. So on the ground motion at Fukushima or on the coast of Japan, the reactors did scram or shut down. But you have this tremendous decay heat. It's, you know, it's like a hot iron that you turn off, but it's still hot.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to provide cooling. And they did provide cooling for about 45 minutes until the tsunami came through.
Right.
And then the tsunami, that water, really the water ingress, well, the earthquake initially was loss of off-site electrical power, which is not a good thing for, also not a good thing for a weak point for nuclear power plants. And then the tsunami came through and then really inundated all their backup systems like the emergency diesel generators.
Right.
So that, with the decay still there, the human, the first responders and emergency responders had, with no power at all and no indicators, had to respond to maintaining the cooling of the reactor.
Right.
So actually there was not a, a mechanical failure, except that your safety systems became unavailable. I think that's maybe a operational design, partially a design error, partially an operational failure.
Okay.
Yeah, you didn't have the cooling system available, so they had to improvise.
Right.
So
And so I look at that and I think of it as being, my initial thought was, well, this is a design problem because someone didn't design for a big enough disaster, but If you've never had that size, that combination of earthquake and tsunami, how would you ever know how big you had to, you know, how big a disaster you had to design for?
Yeah. So I think the plants were designed for improbable events, one single improbable event, and not two one after the other coming in sequence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the big technical lesson learned, is that you can have two improbable events that can impact, you know, one after the other, impact the state of the plant. So everything was okay after the earthquake, and all the safety systems are working as planned. But then they had a historical tsunami that came through as well. So, and then just as if you're driving on the freeway and you have a blowout, you as an operator, you were on cruise control and you had a blowout, you have to intervene right away.
Right.
As an operator. And so you have very little time to get your system under control. And that's really the same kind of situation at the plant. So, and the only, I think, the only fact is that, within about a 2 hour period, it's possible to start melting the core, the reactor core. So, because there's enough decay heat to melt the fuel and the cladding, that's called the cladding material, of the reactor. So, if you go back to the car analogy, if you have a blowout that, you know, you're driving 70 miles an hour, you have essentially about a few seconds to get your car under control, or you're going to flip off the road. All right. So you have to go from a 70 miles per hour, operational envelope to 10 miles an hour at which you can drive on a blowout, right?
Right.
If they lost electrical power, I'm imagining the major concern is running pumps, right?
Yes.
So what could they improvise at that point? How are they not totally helpless?
Well, they were off the what's called the Severe Accident Management Guideline Manual, SAMG. Mm-hmm. And the first thing they did was to go out and get the car batteries out of the parking lots from the cars. And wow. they hooked them up in series and then powered up the instrumentation panel. So when you're in that situation, you with the reactor, you cannot have any kind of effective emergency response or first response strategy unless you know the pressure, the temperature, mm-hmm. The liquid level in tanks, the valve position, and the mass flow rate out of the pumps. So if you're missing any of those five pieces of information, you have to go and rely on experience and best estimate or experiential best guess on what the reactor condition is.
Okay, so after they know how hosed they are, mm-hmm. what do they do?
Well, the first thing they saw after they connected the batteries, and then they saw some of the indicators, they saw that the pressure was high and the temperature was high. So then they had to scramble to provide cooling. So that's, when you see that, that's confirmation that you have to provide cooling, mm-hmm. which is confirming what you already suspected, actually. Because the decay heat is there regardless of whether you have cooling or not.
So did they almost immediately start venting to relieve pressure?
No, that was one of the concerns, was that you have to do this, strategically you have to do this operation called feed and bleed, feeding more coolant in a liquid state, but then you have to bleed off the steam, which dispels the thermal energy. So, and you also lose some mass, but it's in the form of, vapor. So,
yeah.
And then you can't, it's like, it's very hard to pump up a tire that's already fully inflated. You have to have a pinhole to release some mass to put in more mass, right? So that's, you have to do. And they didn't really do that. So, and they were reluctant to release radioactive steam. So mm-hmm. there was that concern. There were some other operational concerns. I think the Prime Minister wanted to fly over the plant in a helicopter. So they waited on releasing, venting off steam. So, but that had an impact on melting the core, if I remember. So, those are all procedural. And, under normal circumstances with the electrical power and the emergency diesel generators working and the pumps working, that, they can go strictly by manual, emergency management manual. So, they were not able to do that. It's hard to put the blame on people. I think, when you have a power outage at your house, or when you, at night, when you need to go walk through your house, to the kitchen, do you know where everything is in your house so that you don't stub your toe on the corner of piece of furniture? Mm-hmm. That's the situation. They were in complete darkness. And the cell phone and some flashlights provided all the lighting that there was. So, you're asking a group of operators to manage under those conditions.
So, what was the scope of the disaster? I mean, everything is always being put in terms of, is it another Chernobyl? Is it another Chernobyl? Was there ever a containment vessel breach in any of the reactors?
It doesn't look like there was. We haven't been able to confirm that, go in and actually look.
But it's certainly not Chernobyl, which, to my recollection, the core actually burned in open air.
Yeah, that's not the case. They did have hydrogen explosions at Fukushima. But, I would say that no two accidents are exactly the same.
Yeah.
So there's a tendency to quickly go back to comparing Fukushima to Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, because those are the only other notable reactor accidents. But I would stress that no accidents are alike, and this is also a unique. In some respects, maybe the only similarity is that Fukushima is a nuclear power plant, just like Chernobyl and also Three Mile Island. But you're comparing. Yeah. You're comparing three different animals. So it is a bad accident. You have three melted cores. That's at one nuclear plant site. That's never been seen before. But I'm not sure that there's a point in going through this international nuclear event scale, INUS. It's on the same rating as Fukushima and Chernobyl are both rated INUS Event 7, Level 7. But does the nuclear reactor that with the core that's melted, does it know that it just had an INUS 7, Level 7 accident? I don't think so. I don't think it cares very much.
Right.
So that's a human judgment that's placed on the severity of the accident.
Now, is there a severe risk of a change in criticality when the core melts? I know very little about. I know from my recollection, criticality is a density and geometry issue. Is it not?
Yes, it is. It's a density and geometry issue, and
and
fuel material. So you've destroyed that material, and you melted that material. You've destroyed the. What I meant was you destroyed the geometry of configuration. Mm-hmm. But it's the way it's designed is that there are discrete chunks of fuel and then coolant and what's called a moderator and a reflector and so forth. Those are designed to be in separate pieces as designed and as in function. So you've destroyed that configuration and you've mixed the materials by melting it. I would think that it's unlikely that you can get what's called a recriticality. Mm-hmm. But as engineers, you want to be sure. And we won't know that until we have a better information on the state of the melted core. So I would go back to a bad analogy. It's like putting on a cookie tray a stack of well-positioned candles in an array, and you put it in the oven, now you melt it into one blob. So I would like to know, we need to know how did it spread in the melted form? And, where is most of that mass and how is the mass distributed in the melted form? So until we know something about that, we really don't have any idea. One good guess is as good as another in terms of if it's possible to have recriticality, because you need to know the geometry.
And how does that information come about? How will you eventually know?
At Three Mile Island, it was 6 years later, 1985. The accident was in 79. The first visual video images were in 85.
Okay.
So that's the quickest way. I mean, that's the first way that we'll have visual image of what the reactor core might look like.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. So
and
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. You won't be able to get that until all the residual heat is off the system, right?
Yeah, essentially, or conditions so that you can get a irradiation resistant video camera there. Mm-hmm. Inside. So I would say that's going to be in I would hope that it's in 2014, 2015, maybe 2015. That's what I anticipate. So the accident was in 2011, so 4 years later, maybe. With video technology much better than it was in 1979. Yeah, we'll probably be able to get some core images, and I hope by 2015.
So in the aftermath of this accident, I've not followed the story real closely, but my recollection is that in the past several weeks, Japan has decided to shut down all its nuclear reactors.
Mm-hmm.
So how did we get from this point of one plant having problems to the point where we're shutting down all the reactors in the entire nation?
Well, that's, I don't know. I don't know. You might call it a knee-jerk reaction. They went from 54 reactors providing 30% of the electricity demand to essentially nothing.
Right.
And that's partially public perception. So there was really no choice but to shut everything down to reestablish if any or all of these plants are in working order after the earthquake and so on. So, mm-hmm. But first of all, after the earthquake, and then there were some other plants that were in the path of the tsunami that were not damaged, but make sure that they're in operating condition. So, because I think along with the what happened at the Fukushima is that it became clear that the preparedness or the readiness for operation of the reactor was not on good footing. So I think all the plants are undergoing scrutiny, or what's called restart.
Right.
So I saw the headlines that they're back down to zero. They had two reactors that were operating in locations very far away from the earthquake and tsunami, but they're back down to zero. So, or I guess I should correct myself. They're at zero nuclear power plants operating.
Right. I know that in the aftermath, there were a lot of statements by the government and statements by the power plant operators that either turned out to be only partially true or not very true at all. Mm-hmm. So how did that play into this public perception? Was there a trust violation there?
Oh, I would say so. So one of the things that also became apparent is and these are kind of culturally dependent, you know, the risk, what's called risk, what I call risk communication, and then crisis management is very important post any widely, broadcast event mm-hmm. or disaster. The U.S. certainly has much more experience in that, 9/11 and Katrina and so forth. We talk a lot about compared to before 2001. We talk a lot about first responders, emergency preparedness.
Right.
That was really not in our vernacular before in the 1990s. So Japan is going through that. I mean, I think they now realize that risk communication is really important, and then crisis management is also as important as well.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's how that happened, it quickly eroded the public confidence in the government and also the utility, I think.
And I would suspect that public opinion has had a lot to do with the government decision to shut down all the reactors.
Yes, yes, yes.
There was no indication that any of the other reactors should have similar problems, since none of them would be likely to suffer the same pair of catastrophic events.
Right. There was actually a plant called the Omagawa plant that was closer to the epicenter, but it had a tsunami wall that was just high enough for the tsunami that came in.
Hmm.
So they were able to successfully shut down and then go to a cold shutdown status, a safe status. And that plant, I think the International Atomic Energy Agency sent an inspection crew walking through for damage, and that plant is intact. Almost no damage. It was, amazingly a success story, but it has not been told.
Hmm.
That, that plant is sitting. All the plants will have to reapply for a restart and demonstrate that they're it's in a condition that's ready to restart. So I think slowly and over a number of years, maybe over a 10-year period, you'll see, some of the plants come back online.
Now, in past talks that you've given talking about this situation, you've used a risk map where you map out the hazards versus the relative risks of various items.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk about that a little bit? I mean, we all know that when we go on a plane, a commercial jet, mm-hmm. that there's a chance that something should happen, but that chance is very remote. And so we're willing to, to jump on that plane and the disasters with nuclear power plants can be much larger than a single jet, but again, there's some limit to that risk.
Right. So that the risk research is or risk perception research
mm-hmm.
and risk perception in society. That's a research area that started in the late '60s, and there's some good early work that produced this what's called a risk map, and you have the X and Y coordinates, and you plot on one scale the unknown risk, and then on the other axis you plot the dreaded risk or dreaded consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other point is that risk is a spectrum. So you mentioned flying on a commercial airline, downhill skiing, you know, riding your motorcycle without a helmet. All those are risky activities that can possibly end in a fatality. Generally speaking, people have that research area has proven that people dread what's unknown and what's known, like nuclear warfare. They know something about it, and the unknown unknown is certainly induces a lot of fear. And the dreaded known of, you know, mutations or possibly fatal radiation exposure, that's also induces a lot of fear. So that risk map is, you know, has, it's essentially a individual and societal ratio of the perception of benefit versus perception of risk for a particular activity. Like, you know, downhill skiing or, you know, being on a commercial airline, you make that choice, right?
Yeah.
So I always, you know, I always joke about with my class, I point out the example of that show, Man versus Food. Should I eat this 30-inch diameter pizza? You know, should I go for that challenge? You know, what am I risking?
Right.
So that's a personal choice that you make. Each person makes, and also society kind of in consensus makes. So yeah, that's the concept of the risk map. It's an interesting plot that shows certainly even culturally or by country that there are differences in the perception of the benefit versus the perception of risk in terms of, for example, cigarette smoking. Right. So, and that it changes in time as well.
Right. When we try to judge things on an absolute basis, we judge distances. We're very good judging things relative. We can sense relative pitch, but we're usually not good at absolute pitch. We're good at relative distances or relative movements as opposed to absolute. So does the same thing happen in risk assessment?
Yeah, I think so. Well, in terms of risk, what we tend to do is we tend to distill down to one metric is that, you know, like fatalities per year or how many additional fatalities per year because of additional radiation exposure or so.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to it's often difficult to take the complex issue and then distill it down to one metric. So we can do that, and you come up with an absolute and say, because of Fukushima, Japan will experience 100 additional cancer deaths compared to the national annual average, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But does that tell the details of the story or the details behind how that number absolute figure was calculated or estimated? Probably not. There's much more to that. And you also, when you come up with the absolute number, you also have to really talk about what is the uncertainty or the error associated with that number as well. That's also important.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
well, it does. It makes it interesting. It just seems to me that in a lot of fields of engineering, you know, we do things that are related to safety factor. I mean, if you're designing an elevator, I think the safety factor is like 11 on the cables that pull the elevator. And I know if you're building a bridge, there are certain safety factors, or if you're doing a pressure vessel, you know, you can look up the SME specs for a certain safety factor on those things.
Right.
But that's different. And you can do the same thing in nuclear engineering, I'm sure, but that's a different than the public perception of risk. You know, how do individuals and society as a whole perceive the risk of the bridge falling down as opposed to the actual risk of the bridge falling down?
Yeah, so I think that's a topic that's interesting. I've done a little bit of research in that in terms of safety culture, and that's there's a societal threshold that's acceptable, and beyond that threshold, that's not acceptable. So typically, you know, commercial airline crash a year, let's say 200 fatalities, which is something that happens in a typical year, that's almost to the threshold that it's acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you have three commercial airlines and 200 fatalities three times, you know, during any calendar year, I would say then that's not acceptable, and you'll see the call for action, or you know, for some safety, you know, reviews, right?
Right.
So, and unfortunately, with nuclear power, because of the unknown and the dreaded known, those two factors, it's amplified. So, no, you know, to have one person, that's one of the publications I have, one person die because of radiation exposure at a nuclear power plant accident is, because of the media coverage, you know, it amplified. It's about as equivalent as having 1,000 people die from the accident. You know, although, in fact, in factual terms, maybe only one person has died. It's in the media that there's so much coverage that it's as if 1,000 people had disappeared.
Wow.
So there's a media amplification factor to, relative to the safety culture of what's acceptable in society in terms of the hazardous materials and hazardous installations.
Hmm.
Yeah. So a car accident, it doesn't even make the, 11 PM news, right?
Right.
Yeah. But airline crash certainly makes the 11 PM news, and a nuclear reactor accident certainly makes all the news, right?
So right.
I think that's the point.
Unfortunately, I think of that part of that is due to the rarity of,
yes.
Various incidents.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you have
you're
a lot
right.
of car crashes. We don't have very many reactor accidents.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a learned behavior that you know these things, you know, things, accidents happen. You know, people do get killed from automobile accidents, and that somehow becomes acceptable in society. Right.
That and there's a general phobia with respect to anything radioactive.
Oh yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That you know. It's not totally unjustified, but it's kind of irrational and
yeah.
a lot of
yeah.
just.
Yeah. Well,
is that you have it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's you know, it's basically you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't touch it, you know. But it's fate. It can be potentially fatal. So, that's you know we live from our senses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So. You know, you can all your instruments on in a car can go out. But then, if you want to know how fast you're going, you open the window, right, and look out to see how fast the pavement is going by. So you mm-hmm. you get a sense of the speed that you're going without the instruments, right? So, but that's so we live. For, I would say that we live from our senses in terms of, you know, the human being is actually a sensor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in many respects, and especially so when you're operating a piece of equipment.
And I don't think our schools do a very good job of educating people. I mean, people treat radiation like it's, you know, one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't think, actually, I know most people, you know, couldn't tell you the difference between an alpha emitter and a beta emitter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that the relative danger is, you know, related to half-life and its emission type.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and I was talking to somebody recently. And maybe you can help me source this quote, or maybe it's just apocryphal. You start, gram for gram, you start eating caffeine and I'll start eating uranium and you'll die first.
Mm, I see.
I don't know if you've heard that one before.
No, I haven't, but you're ingesting, you know, when you're eating a banana, there's potassium 40, which is a radioactive form of isotope of potassium. So, you know, you have milligrams in your body that you have, that's internal to you. So, and we live and bathe in, you know, electromagnetic radiation, including ionizing radiation. So we have, mm-hmm. the earth is radioactive. There's natural background radiation, and we can go up twice that natural, background exposure from x-rays or CT scans or, you know, as a result of nuclear medicine as part of the medical, you know, diagnosis. So, and that's voluntary. But, you know, I guess the thing is the involuntary exposure is what's not acceptable, of course. So, but the involuntary exposure to radiation is also, we have a lot of other things, you know, involuntary exposure to other, there are many, many other toxins that one is exposed to involuntarily.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, the issue with secondhand smoking is the involuntary ingestion of, smoke. So, and that's why that I think, my opinion is that's why that became an issue. So, Yeah. It's an interesting, these are interesting topics, and hopefully there's a community that will advance research or look at, investigate how these things, safety culture and, perception of benefit and risk and so forth, risk maps, how that develops.
So it also seems that there's a lot of innovation that's happening, or at least there's a lot of videos that have been published recently relating to, more exotic and hypothetical reactors, everything from pebble bed, traveling wave, and, I think a popular one recently has been the liquid fluoride thorium reactor. Do any of those excite you in any way, or are they all kind of on the fringes of plausibility?
No, I think many of these ideas, came about in the early days. They're very interesting. The industry and the country decided that we would go with what we call, light water reactors, pressurized water reactors or boiling water reactors. And we built the whole industry behind that. So just as with early automobiles, with the stainless steamer and so forth, there are, from way back when, some exotic reactor designs. And they're worth, I think, building maybe a demonstration, a smaller scale demonstration reactor or a test or research reactor with, demonstrating that a kind of a proof of concept, right? But to say that we're going to deploy, another fleet of, small modular reactors that are, graphite cooled and helium and helium coolant and so forth, that's another matter. So that's because that's relative to what's established, in terms of BWRs and PWRs. It's a disruptive technology, right? So go back to, the Toyota Corolla that came into the United States, 1965 or so, relative to the big four automakers at that time with big sedans, right? And, as engineers, we often talk about disruptive technologies and how that happens, right? It takes maybe roughly 30 years for that, if it's viable and sustainable, that technology to infiltrate into the marketplace. So I think if maybe part of the answer is that, I think we should build them at a smaller scale as a proof of concept. I think that would be interesting. So I as an engineer, you're asking an engineer. So, I am interested in all these kinds of concepts. Some of them are very, interesting and really stretches the imagination and the analytical and the engineering capabilities, because some of the concepts are very, very, very different. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it can be a driver for the development of new methods and new tools and new approaches in engineering.
And how big a plant does one have to build to be meaningful?
Well, I think on the order of, what's on university, some 20, 25 university campuses, 1 megawatt or 10 megawatts, thermal, not necessarily electric. So I would say, between, maybe to be engineering skill, maybe 10 to 50 megawatt thermal.
Okay.
So, one third of that is, 15 to 17 if it had a turbine generator building, 15 to 17 or 15 to 20 megawatt electric to make it a viable or a valid demonstration.
And what kind of investment would be involved in that?
That might be something on the order of $500 to $1 billion.
Okay, so
in total R&D and engineering and deployment or construction and everything. So it might be a $1 billion undertaking.
So a pretty big chunk of change.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Are there a lot of these $1 billion experiments underway?
Well, what is $1 billion these days? It seems like a lot of money. It seems like a lot of money for an individual.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of the things that we do, I do in class is we can consider the size of financial initiatives we're undertaking. So $1 billion is chunk, a big chunk of change for a nuclear utility. But for ExxonMobil, when they're making $40 billion in profit per quarter, it's not much, not much change. Right? If they're making $160 billion a year in profit, ExxonMobil, as a global, a multinational, can they spend $1 billion to build an exotic reactor? I think the answer is yes. If the market viability argument can be made. So, you know, that, I think the point I'm making is that that's why I asked, you know, what's $1 billion these days? You know, who commands $1 billion? So, with Wikipedia, you know, you're able to look at somebody. So how big is Microsoft? Is it more than $1 billion company? The answer is yes. But is it a company that makes $40 billion per quarter? The answer is no. So I think with all this IT and high tech, it's an interesting comparison to look at. What is the size? What is the liquid capital of companies? And, you know, how much are they investing in terms of R&D?
Is there a lot of private work being done, or is it primarily public research?
It's mostly public research. And that's why we're talking about small modular reactors, because the investments are small, because the reactors are small. So there's some financial, you know, houses that are, you know, really looking to see if we had to spend $500 million to build a small modular reactor, an SMR, and they operated for 40 years, gave constant, you know, return on profit on the investment. Maybe that's market viable. So number of financial institutions are looking at that as investments. Not the full-blown plants, the Generation 2 plants or 3 plants or Generation 4 plants that we have, but the smaller exotic reactors that are potentially going to be licensed and manufactured. There's some institutions that are looking at that as investments.
Isn't there a company out of New Mexico, if I remember correctly, Hyperion?
Yeah, Hyperion was proposing a very small 25 to 50 megawatt thermal reactor. Mm-hmm.
And did it ever get past the proposal, or?
No, I think it's kind of on the back burner. Mm-hmm. It's a very exotic reactor, and I think that right now the ones that are receiving some subsidy from the U.S. government is the water-based small modular reactor concept.
Mm-hmm. We've talked a little bit about the safety of the plant, but one thing that seems to be a continuing issue here in the United States is what gets done with the spent nuclear fuel. Is any progress being made in that area, or is it always a not-in-my-backyard problem?
Well, there is that not in my backyard, and you know, we had Yucca Mountain as the federal site to put used, or the term changes a little bit, used or spent fuel. Mm-hmm. But you know, the congressional folks from the state of Nevada were clever enough to really derail that plan. So we're back to zero, and the president did appoint a commission to restudy how we handle as a nation the nuclear waste, and they have made recommendations, and we'll see what happens. We're back. We don't have a place to put spent nuclear or used nuclear fuel. Mm-hmm. They're on site at the nuclear power plants.
Right.
Yeah. So,
you see that as at this point you believe it to be more a political problem than a technical problem.
Yeah, it's not a technical problem. It's a political problem, and it's a kind of a regulatory problem. The French have an interesting, I went to France to visit one of their underground, spent fuel, used fuel sites. They consider it used fuel, and the French consider their equivalent to Yucca Mountain as not permanent storage, but interim storage, which means that you have to make the facility so that if and when the fuel needs to be retrieved, because it's not completely burned,
right,
that you're able to access and retrieve that fuel. And in the U.S., my understanding is that the facilities, the Yakamata was permanent storage. And one of the issues was the long-lived isotope, like, you know, plutonium or uranium, you know, million years or 250,000 years or longer. That's a very difficult question to answer. I'm not sure, you know, can Congress answer or guarantee to the American people, will they be around in 250,000 years from now?
Right.
So, you know, we can't even get through a continuing resolution. So, so that's that question is there. But that may be hinging on this question, you know, permanent versus interim. That's a regulatory definition, if I'm making my point clear.
Well, you, I think you're also maybe glossing over something most people aren't aware of. Could you speak about the reprocessing, the state of the reprocessing industry in the U.S.?
We have the technology. We have the means, but it's not commercialized. So, you know, there's what's called the front end. I mean, uranium is just like any other ore. It's mined, and it's transformed into some form that's usable. So it's, you know, it's mined out of rock, right, earth, and then processed so that you make it into fuel forms, and then you take it out of the reactor. It's only partially burned. You put a label on it as used fuel or spent fuel, and we had the technology to chop it up and separate the metals from the fuel and so forth. And that what's called the back end of the fuel cycle is not a commercial, fully commercial business.
Wasn't it at one point in the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, we were moving along toward, you know, that a full-blown commercialization, but we have backtracked.
Is that go ahead.
Well, that's again a safety and proliferation concern. You have the technology to separate uranium from plutonium. So you start with a reactor. You start with fresh uranium fuel, but as you burn it, you produce plutonium. So you have a mixture of plutonium and uranium. Both are fuels, or can be fuels, in a reactor. But then when you label it as used fuel or spent fuel, you typically separate out the plutonium and the uranium, and there's the proliferation concern. As weapon candidate material. So that's a legacy of the Carter administration, and we still do not fully recycle fuel in the United States. We have what's called a once-through cycle. Well, it's not really a cycle, it's a one-through system. So,
right.
Yeah. That's a political, not an economic or a technical.
Yeah, and it's and in this case, it's the legacy of the Carter administration. So, probably time to change that. But often with presidential candidates and presidents, it's not a high priority.
It has tremendous implications for the amount of waste that's produced, does it not?
Well, the amount of waste is actually very small.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stigma attached to that waste. I'll just, you know, say that. So, there are a lot of implication and stigma attached to that waste. So it in volume, it's not very much, you know, but, again, maybe perhaps because it's weapon. Some of it is weapons candidate material that we tend to be hypersensitive. Maybe good, maybe bad.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Other than recycling, is there some other method to maybe reduce the hazardness of these materials, or is that pretty much?
Yeah, there's some research, what's called transmutation, turning, by neutron bombardment of that material, transforming it into another element that has a shorter half-life. So there's that research. It's sometimes ongoing, sometimes not, with, you know, kind of depending on funding, government funding. So, you know, there is some knowledge and expertise on transmutating that, the long-lived weapons-grade material into something else. So that technology is we already have it, or it's just around the corner.
Well, we've run well over the hour mark, and we should probably think about letting you move on with your evening.
Mm-hmm.
But appreciate your coming on the podcast and sharing your expertise.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for the opportunity. Enjoyed it very much.
Terrific. We've already sort of covered that you think that nuclear engineering remains a viable and interesting area for those who may want to consider a career in the nuclear industry.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And if listeners have questions or want to get a hold of you, is there any good place for us to direct them?
Yeah, I think my university address is okay. TOKUHIRO@UIDAHO.edu. University of Idaho, so UIDAHO.edu. Tokyo Heroes, TOKUHIRO.
Fantastic.
We welcome awesome emails. Sure.
Terrific. Well, thank you so very, very much for coming on, being part of our podcast.
Thank you.
The Engineering Commons is produced by Analog Life, LLC, and Engineering Revision. Theme music by Paul Stevenson. For more info, visit theengineeringcommons.com.